You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of July 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Emma Nelson and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we set the day's agenda with Shashank Joshi from the Royal United Services Institute. Shashank, what do you have for us today?
We have South Asia today, a story on India-China, one on India-Pakistan, and then one on a place where they're both very interested, Afghanistan.
Shashank, thank you very much indeed. Also ahead, Nelson Mandela turns 95. We'll hear how South Africans and the rest of the world celebrate Madiba as he's still in critical condition in a Pretoria hospital.
Plus, we'll be finding out why insults hurt and why they shouldn't.
Anytime someone insults you, you listen and think about what's motivating them. And then in most cases, you'll dismiss it. You'll realize they're just playing this game, this social hierarchy game.
And we head to Kosovo, where ethnic divisions are being mended by a rock school.
Before the Kosovo War, Mitrovica was a rock music city. It had a very vibrant rock music scene, lots of events, festivals, things going on, and it's a reputation of the city that has gotten lost in all the talk about the conflict.
All that plus we'll get the latest news from Spain with our man in Madrid. We'll review this morning's British front pages and we'll also play some music as well. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's get the latest world news headlines now from Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Panama has called in the United Nations Security Council to investigate a North Korean ship caught smuggling arms from Cuba. The ship was stopped in the Panama Canal last week and the crew was arrested after military equipment was found in a consignment of brown sugar from Cuba. Cuba says it owns the items, which included missile equipment, MiG fighter jets and other arms. Havana claimed it was obsolete equipment from the Soviet era being sent to North Korea for repair. Panama's foreign ministry says five UN investigators, including one from the Security Council, are expected to arrive at the end of July once the ship's been unloaded. Pyongyang has called for the immediate release of the ship and its 35-strong crew. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says Egypt avoided a possible civil war this month, making it hard for Washington to conclude that the overthrow of the Islamist President Mohamed Morsi was a military coup. The armed forces deposed the elected leader on July the 3rd after huge street protests against his rule. That cleared the way for a new interim cabinet to be installed this week. Supporters of Mr. Morsi have been angered that the U.S. hasn't officially condemned the army's move as a coup, but Mr. Kerry said that would be a tough call.
You had an extraordinary situation in Egypt of life and death, of the potential of civil war and enormous violence, and you now have a constitutional process proceeding forward very rapidly. So we have to measure all of those facts against the law.
President Obama's nominee as U.S. ambassador to the United Nations has launched a major attack on the UN Security Council's response to Syria's civil war. Speaking at her confirmation hearing before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Samantha Power called Syria one of the worst cases of mass brutality that she's ever seen. And she criticised the UN's handling of other crises.
Within the UN, an organization built in part to apply the lessons of the Holocaust, we also see unacceptable attacks against the State of Israel. We see the absurdity of Iran chairing the UN Conference on Disarmament. We see the failure of the UN Security Council to respond to the slaughter in Syria, a disgrace that history will judge harshly.
A cook who prepared school meals that killed 25 children in India has blamed contaminated cooking oil for the tragedy. At least a dozen of the children are still in hospital, two remain in a critical condition. The children, aged 4 to 12, fell ill on Tuesday after consuming a lunch of rice, soybean and lentils in the eastern state of Bihar. Doctors believe the food, which was provided under a government free meals scheme, had been contaminated by insecticide. A court in Russia has found the protest leader Alexei Navalny guilty of theft. The judge said the 37-year-old was guilty of organising a scheme to steal at least $500,000 from a state timber firm when he was advising the governor of the Kirov region in 2009. The maximum penalty is 10 years in prison, but prosecutors are calling for a 6-year sentence. He says the trial was politically motivated because of his opposition to President Vladimir Putin. He's also said he'd like to be president, and on Wednesday he was registered to run in a Moscow mayoral election in September. South Africa is celebrating Nelson Mandela's 95th birthday today, as the former president continues to be treated for a lung infection in hospital in Pretoria. He was admitted on June the 8th. President Jacob Zuma says his condition is steadily improving. On the eve of his birthday, many of Mandela's friends attended a prayer service at Johannesburg City Hall. Among them was his former wife, Winnie, who thanked the media for its support.
Thank you very much for all your prayers. The best gift you have given us through your prayers is to share Tata's birthday on the 95th. Now, you will turn all those structures you had erected around my house, meaning all those satellites there, we'll turn them into centres of celebration.
Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Barney. And we will be getting more on Nelson Mandela's birthday in about 10 minutes from now with Martin Plout. But it's about 6 minutes now past the hour here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Hong Kong
to Shanghai
to Jakarta
to Moscow
to Los Angeles
to Beijing
to Yokohama
to Amsterdam,
to Cairo,
to Karachi,
to Bogota,
all around the world. This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London. It's time now for us to set the day's agenda with the three big stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, joining us now in the studio is Shashank Joshi from the Royal United Services Institute. Shashank, many thanks for coming into the studio.
Of course.
Where shall we begin today? India-China relations, perhaps?
Absolutely. Well, you know, these are all South Asian stories connected to each other, but the India one's particularly interesting. It tells you a lot of things about the way politics is going in South Asia. This is a story India is raising a new mountain strike corps. So, you know, corps is a pretty huge military formation. We're talking here about 45,000 soldiers. I mean, this is half the size of the, more than half the size of the new British Army. And that's just an unit they're raising. And the mind boggles to compare scale, whether in procurement of aircraft, whether in raising these new divisions, as to what's going on in Asia, in the Middle East, compared to what's happening in Europe, where our armies are shrinking. And it also tells you about the way in which India's relationship with China is so at a real inflection point, so anxious, so tense. You know, there have been huge border flare-ups over the past several years, the biggest coming earlier this year when the Chinese set up a tent on the Indian side and refused to leave. So this is, I think, what we're seeing, that the beginning of real intense military competition in South Asia.
That flare-up earlier on this year ended very meekly, after an awful lot of tub-thumping from the likes of Manmohan Singh.
It did. One of the
and
reasons
the Chinese has quietly just went back.
Well, they made their point, which was that you can't kick us out and we can do this with impunity. And it's a form of probing, seeing what India's responses are. But here's the important thing. Why did it end meekly? Why didn't India escalate? Well, partly because China has spent the last 10 years holding dozens of exercises, building roads, building bases, and India has been incredibly slow. This decision has been on the table for years, and it was only just approved by the Indian cabinet. India moves slowly. It's a sluggish great power. And it tells you that the reason this is being raised is to give them some muscle so they don't have to react meekly in those circumstances.
And this also, this announcement just comes days after the Indian government announced that they're going to be deploying a surveillance camera along the border area in the Chumar region between China and India. So that's, I guess, an interesting development on that front. But the question, Shashank, is do you think India now is really taking advantage of perhaps the ongoing dispute between Japan and China over the Senkaku Islands? And this is really India seeing this as an opportunity to strengthen ties with Japan, considering Manmohan Singh was just in Tokyo quite recently as well.
Do you know what? On a bigger scale, you're right. India has been strengthening relations not just with Japan, but also with the swing states of East Asia, who've all been a little bit worried by Chinese behavior. Japan, South Korea, Vietnam, and so on. But you know, the really interesting thing is how little they've taken advantage of it. Japan said, please sell us military equipment. You know, Japan has never sold countries military equipment or really imported it from other than Americans. Japan wanted India to be involved in multilateral naval exercises. India said, no thanks, we'll stick to bilateral ones, we don't want to irritate the Chinese. So what's really fascinating is actually how India is trapped in this sort of wariness of irking China too much. It doesn't like being caught up in what it sees as the US pivot against China. So this tells you about India's psyche as a great power. It doesn't like the concept of getting sucked into these alliances.
What does it say about India's psyche internally? The fact that you said that this has taken a very long time to come about. Do you ever get the impression that the politicking actually takes over the broader picture? As you said, that, you know, they haven't taken advantage of their good relationship with Japan. Is it because they just spend so much time arguing among themselves that they never seem to be able to make a decision?
Part of it is absolutely that. And one of the reasons they spend so long arguing is a long history of severe corruption for procurement or for anything like that. So the civil servants are burnt. They know they authorise a deal. It could come back and bite them. Someone could say, well, look, you had a $100 million backhander on this agreement. So that paralyzes some of these big decisions. You also, of course, have a big contrast with China, where despite China's relatively complex bureaucracy, stuff can get done from the top down. Here, let's say you want to raise a new camera in Arunachal Pradesh or a border state. Well, good luck. You've got to go through their local government, the armed forces, the civil service, your cabinet, perhaps other coalition parties. I can tell you, the CCP in China does not have the problem of other coalition parties.
And Zhang, another story which you've picked up for us, some astounding claims about who exactly was behind those horrible terror attacks in Mumbai a few years ago.
Astounding, or probably nonsensical. This is an Indian civil servant, a member of the special investigating team of India's CBI, the Central Bureau of Investigation, has said the government orchestrated the Mumbai attacks in 2008. And not only that, but they also orchestrated the parliament attacks about 12 years ago, if you remember them, on India's parliament building, 2001-2, in order to pass robust counter-terrorism legislation. So here are your Indian truthers, as you know, those who think the Twin Towers were brought down by the government.
It's absolute classic daft conspiracies.
It's nonsense. But
how's it made it to air? Why is it surfaced?
I honestly could not tell you why this has surfaced. There are some reports in the last 24 hours that suggest he has walked back some of these claims. The reason I picked this out, though, is it highlights how fraught India-Pakistan relations are. This story was where they went wild with it in the Pakistani press. And for India, the core issue of outstanding disputes really is Mumbai. Why haven't the Pakistanis brought the Mumbai perpetrators to justice yet and admitted everything they know? This story and the reception it got in Pakistan tells you how incredibly far we are, despite the election of a new pro-peace president in Pakistan, Nawaz Sharif, from achieving that sort of cross-border reconciliation on the issue. We're a long, long way from it if stories like this are seen as credible anywhere, really.
And finally, Shashank, a country that everyone continues to keep their gaze fixed upon, Afghanistan.
I was in Afghanistan a couple of weeks ago, and one of the things everyone talks about isn't the insurgency or the military or all of those things. It's the politics and it's next year's election. There is immense anxiety. Now, what happened yesterday in Afghanistan was some really good news. Hamid Karzai essentially agreed to two new laws that allow the appointment of an independent election commission and a complaints commission. It seems really, you know, quite in the weeds. But it's crucial because it will guard against some of the errors we saw in 2009 when fraud occurred. This time round, if fraud occurs, it's not just a matter for the Afghan government. It means the entire international effort to pump money into Afghanistan just won't be able to happen. And this guards against that a little bit.
It guards against it, but how successful do you think it will be, given the fact that Karzai mounted such a strong objection to it?
Well, he's agreed to it, but I think the problem here is there's still about a dozen ways in which things can go wrong in the election. You would have a corrupt winner who wins freely and fairly, a runoff where people dispute who won the most votes, you could have violence, suppress voting in certain provinces. There's dozens of ways in which the entire process can be tarred as illegitimate. And then, can our politicians justify giving £4 billion to Afghanistan every year?
Absolutely. Thanks very much, Shashank Joshi from RUSI, with the three stories we'll need to know today, setting our day's agenda. Many thanks.
Next up on Midori House, we're in South Africa for Mandela Day.
Who's that big, handsome thing getting all the looks on the beach, attracting envious glances by the pool and too many amorous advances in the sun-dappled cafe? That's right, it's Monocle Mediterraneo, a big, bold, large-format newspaper that reports from the sunnier southern European spots each summer. Our editors have been scouring ports on the rise and plage for pleasure to bring you a host of reads to enjoy with your Aperol this vacation season.
In the design section, we kick back in two stunning holiday residences, a mid-century gem on the volcanic island of Pantelleria and a beautifully crafted fortress in the Atlas Mountains. We also go on an architour around the Sarrià Sangiovese district of Barcelona and uncover some beautifully intact post-war designs.
In the edit section, we relax and take a break by the beach while we await our food and drink to be served, courtesy of four Mediterranean chefs, including the number one chef in the world. And to keep in shape, we travel to the surf towns of Arachira, Sesme and Batroun to catch a few waves and a bit of sunshine too.
Make sure you get your copy of Monocle Mediterraneo. It's on newsstands now, or order a copy from monocle.com. You'll be the envy of all the lounger lizards.
And welcome back to Midori House, where the time is 17:15 in Melbourne, it's 11:15 in Moscow, and 8:15 here in London. Now, Nelson Mandela celebrates his 95th birthday today, Thursday. It's a milestone very few expected him to see, if you consider the recent media resources ploughed into what was supposed to be his imminent passing once he was admitted to a hospital in Pretoria.
Mandela remained critically ill, so this birthday will be a strange one. So how is it being celebrated? Joining us now is the journalist Martin Plout, former Africa editor for BBC World Service and a fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies. Welcome back to the programme, Martin.
Thank you.
The way we described there was a sort of a bittersweet birthday that everybody's facing.
Well, I think it's become a little sweeter because Mac Maharaj, the presidential spokesman, has just announced that Mandela is steadily improving from the lung infection that he was suffering from. He's been in hospital something like 6 weeks. And his daughter, one of his daughters, is saying that he's watching television with headphones on and may soon return home.
And do you think those rumours are true that he indeed will return home sooner than later?
Well, it's a rumour. Well, let's see. I mean, I wouldn't predict anything with a man of that age. Let's be hopeful at least.
Let's talk about this issue of hope, because we have seen the last 6 or 7 weeks there has been circling around this hospital in Pretoria, and I think the world has been on death watch for him to a degree that I think has astonished a lot of us.
I think that's absolutely correct. I mean, it has. The only thing it has reminded me really of is Princess Diana's death, when people just frankly lost their marbles. This is an old man. He's going to die. He had great service to South Africa. But he's, you know, there's nothing surprising about this. And there's this hysteria. I mean, in South Africa, it is beyond anything you can imagine. I mean, the whole of today is dedicated to donating 67 minutes to Mandela. Now, if you can tell me why it's 67 minutes, and I do know, I'll be interested.
Well, is that a challenge?
Yes.
So 67 years dedicated to freedom, service.
But why 67? Since he's 95.
It's the man who's a lawyer.
Spent in prison. Go on.
No, because in 2009, the United Nations declared 18th of July to be International Nelson Mandela Day, and he joined the ANC in 1942. Now, they said this was for his promotion of a culture of peace throughout the world.
That seems entirely arbitrary.
Indeed, it is. And he didn't promote a culture of peace when he joined. He was there to jack up the ANC, to start fighting the government and leading to the armed struggle. So, I mean, this is just an extraordinary sort of manipulation of the facts.
So where do you think that Mandela's birthday now sits, given the fact that you have this strange number, which I don't feel so desperately bad about that I didn't know the reason behind.
I'm not surprised.
I sort of cursed myself momentarily, but now don't feel so terrible. But then you also have this sort of death watch that's now become a bit of a sideshow. Looking at the coverage in the media today, there seems to be not quite as much as one would have imagined. I think it's are people sort of holding back,
sense of Mandela fatigue almost?
Yeah.
I think there is in the rest of the world, but there certainly isn't in South Africa. Every newspaper, every radio station, every politician of every party is doing something today for Mandela. There is a complete saturation coverage. There is somebody who is even going around spending 67 minutes, and it was on radio this morning in South Africa, saying he's going to take down adverts for penis enlargements.
Right.
Well, there you go.
That makes me feel so much better. We mentioned a little while ago on The Globalist that the way that Mandela's effect trickles down locally, though, is cannot be underestimated.
No.
There's a little primary school in London where they're having a pretend boxing match today where someone's going to pretend to be Muhammad Ali, who's going to fight Mandela, and Mandela's going to win. It's sweet and it's quaint, but it really does demonstrate how widespread Mandela's influence is.
Well, I think that one of the reasons for this is that we lack secular saints, somebody whom every nationality and every religious group can turn to as an image of good. And particularly in South Africa, to be honest, the country is now bogged down in, frankly, a culture of sleaze and crime and corruption. And here, at last, is one person that everybody can look up to and say, this was a great man. He was our founding president in real democracy. He was a good man, and everybody can look up to him. And that is why, frankly, nobody brooks a moment of criticism of him. And frankly, he wasn't a saint.
Well, and of course, this is all happening at the same time as his family dramas continue over grave sites and such. How is that being played into the coverage of Nelson Mandela's birthday?
Oh, I don't think anybody is mentioning it now because, I mean, it is such a sort of discreditable act that the family have been involved in. I mean, it frankly has all to do with money and the manipulation of Mandela's image in order to make money out of it. I mean, his grandson actually moved three children's bodies from one village to another because he wanted to set up a center in which he was going to make cash out of it. I mean, that's all. Everyone knows that's what it's about. And, you know, 16 members of his family actually put in a legal document saying that he was in a vegetative state at one moment. I mean, it's really become really tawdry. But, you know, none of this manages to rub off on Mandela himself, who is still the most extraordinary man South Africa's produced, certainly in the latter half of the 20th century. And, you know, a man who generally everybody can look up to and revere.
Martin Plaut, many thanks for coming into the studio and looking back at Nelson Mandela's life as it continues on for his birthday today. Former Africa editor for the BBC World Service. Many thanks.
Thank you.
Vanuit London, dit is Monaco 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe, top.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monaco 24.
It's 15:22 in Singapore, 9:22 a.m. in Paris, 4:22 a.m. in Buenos Aires. Now, the insult is an integral part of life. The art of dishing them out, however, and the skill of gracefully being on the receiving end of them are talents indeed. We at Monaco 24 are a polite, well-brought-up bunch. We'd never say a bad word about a soul, now would we, Mr. Hunt?
I certainly would not, Miss Nelson. But one man who became so fascinated with the insult is the author William B. Irvine. His latest book, A Slap in the Face, attempts to explore why humans offend and take offense too. Well, apparently it's all to do with craving to be loved. Just want to be loved, Emma, right?
Of course.
Yeah. Well, William B. Irvine spoke with our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, for more.
We insult each other because we're biologically programmed to insult each other. More generally, we're biologically programmed to play a social hierarchy game in which we try to prove ourselves superior to the people around us.
Is there any particular type of an effective insult?
I think, well, in terms of firepower, repartee, when you have a quick comeback, a quick and witty comeback to an insult someone has directed your way, is remarkably effective. But in my book, what I argue for is responding to insults with no response at all. I call that insult pacifism. I've experimented with that, and I find that it's actually quite effective.
I'm quite a sensitive person, you know, when someone insults me, you know. How should I react? So basically, I should just not care and use your insult pacifism idea.
You should care about what some people think about you, because they're reliable sources of feedback on you and your life. You know, it's a curious thing, but when an enemy insults you, it's possible to take away something from that. Depending on what kind of friends you have, your friends might not tell you about your shortcomings. They might like you too much to do that. Your enemies, though, have no problem at all with telling you about your shortcomings. So anytime someone insults you, you listen and think about what's motivating them. And then in most cases, you'll dismiss it. You'll realize they're just playing this game, this social hierarchy game. If you're a sensible person, you will have dropped out of that game. You are no longer interested in playing it. But in some cases, other people provide you with valuable feedback, and they choose to do it in the form of insults. But so you listen to the insult, you try to extract a kernel of truth from it, and then you do your best to move on in life.
So if someone has a bad review of your book, you just don't care. You have to use the inspiration from some philosophers, right?
Yeah, actually, I did recently get a bad review in a British newspaper. My immediate response was to do nothing and just to think, well, we all have our opinions and move on with life. So I've actually had that challenge.
And it's interesting, in the book you mentioned there's classic examples of insults. Can you share some of them with us, some of them that are iconic?
There are, you know, almost anything by Winston Churchill counts as terrific insults. So he was at a dinner party, and I think it goes kind of like this. Nancy Astor said, you know, Winston Churchill, if you were my husband, I would poison your coffee. He responded by saying, and if you were my wife, I would drink that coffee. Classic example of repartee.
I mean, we have a very international audience here. Do you think insults depends on each nation? For example, are some nations that are particularly insulted very easily, for example?
It's a cultural thing. And within any given nation, there will be subgroups that are either more or less prone to insults. And I mean, another thing, while we're on the topic of insults, there are a whole bunch of insults that are what I call benign insults, or you could use the phrase unsults. They're intended not to inflict pain on other people, but as a curious way to bond social relationships. So this is particularly true of men. They might have relationships with other men that consist primarily of swapping insults. So when you meet each other, you insult each other. I have friendships that have that nature. And it's all understood that it's a part of group membership, that that's just how we display that. But some people, even in my own culture, are opposed to that sort of thing. So individuals who are extremely sensitive to insults, and so you really have to go out of your way to avoid doing anything they'll take as insulting behavior. And if I went to a different country, I would start with the assumption that the people there don't want to be insulted until I got evidence to the contrary.
Well, that was author William B. Irvine speaking to our very sensitive researcher.
He's a little petal, isn't he?
He's very sensitive. Yeah, researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Well, here at Monocle, we don't like insults, do we, Emma?
No, so we'll play some music, but the non-insulting version of CeeLo Green's Forget You.
And that was Forget You by CeeLo Green.
In the next half hour of today's programme, we'll hear the latest news from Madrid, we'll comment on the British front pages, and we'll ask how cities use their spaces to promote reconciliation.
Before the Kosovo war, Mitrovica was a rock music city. It had a very vibrant rock music scene, lots of events, festivals, things going on, and it's a reputation of the city that has gotten lost in all the talk about the conflict.
But before all that, here is Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Phil. Panama has called in the United Nations Security Council to investigate a North Korean ship caught smuggling arms from Cuba. Panama's foreign ministry says five UN investigators, including one from the Security Council, are expected to arrive at the end of July once the ship's been unloaded. US Secretary of State John Kerry says Egypt avoided a possible civil war this month, making it hard for Washington to conclude that the overthrow of Islamist President Mohamed Morsi was a military coup. Supporters of Mr. Morsi have been angered that the US hasn't officially condemned the army's move as a coup. President Obama's nominee as US ambassador to the United Nations has launched a major attack on the UN Security Council's response to the civil war in Syria. Speaking at a confirmation hearing before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Samantha Power called Syria one of the worst cases of mass brutality that she's ever seen. A cook who prepared school meals that killed 25 children in India has blamed contaminated cooking oil for the tragedy. At least a dozen children are still in hospital, two remain in a critical condition. A court in Russia has found the protest leader Alexei Navalny guilty of theft. Prosecutors are calling for a 6-year sentence. He says the trial was politically motivated because of his opposition to President Putin. South Africa is celebrating Nelson Mandela's 95th birthday today as the former president continues to be treated for a lung infection in hospital in Pretoria. He was admitted on June the 8th. President Jacob Zuma says his condition is steadily improving. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Barney, thank you very much indeed. Barney will be back at the top of the hour to bring us a full roundup of the world news, after which Robert Bound will be here to bring you this week's edition of Culture. In the meantime, though, you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson and Phil Hahn. This week, The Urbanist is looking at once divided cities and how they're reconciling. What role does our built environment have on bringing the two sides of a conflict together?
In this preview, we're in Mitrovica. It's become the symbol of ethnic tension in Kosovo. The river which runs through it splits the ethnic Serb and Albanian communities. But one project is trying to bring the two sides together through the power of music. Mitrovica Rock School has been running for 5 years, and it's succeeded where many others have failed in getting young people from both sides of the ethnic divide playing together. Well, our correspondent Guy Deloney went to meet one of the organizers, Wendy Hassler-Forrest.
The Mitrovica Rock School came out of the idea to set up a single rock music school in the divided city of Mitrovica to bring together kids from Serb kids from North Mitrovica, Albanian kids from South Mitrovica. The original idea had been to have one school on the south foot of the bridge. We held on to that plan for a number of years until we realized that that really wasn't realistic. The divide was too strong, and kids aren't going to cross the bridge for music lessons. So then we redevised it where we have branches on both sides of the river, and we bring kids together for mixed events outside Kosovo in neutral territory, as we call it.
Why did you think that a rock school would be a good idea in this divided city, Mitrovica, where you basically, as you say, you've got this river, the Ibar River, and on the south side of it, you've got the ethnic Albanian community. On the north side, you've got mostly ethnic Serb community there. One of the bridges is blocked to road traffic. You can just about walk across. Why a rock school as a reconciliation project?
Before the Kosovo War, Mitrovica was a rock music city. It had a very vibrant rock music scene, lots of events, festivals, things going on, and that was something that was shared by both sides. And that's also something that both sides are still proud of, and it's a reputation of the city that has gotten lost in all the talk about the conflict, basically. So we are helping the city to revive that scene. Another reason is that music was part of the conflict. There was what is known here as turbo folk. Every group has their own variety of it, but it's basically the same. It's some kind of cheap mix of folk music and commercial pop, which is usually nationalist or sexist or a combination of those. A lot of the rock music clubs in Mitrovica had been closed and had been replaced by turbo folk places. The rock scene, which was open and shared, had been diminished by this nationalist brand of music. And there was still a group of musicians who felt very strongly about it, and they wanted to take the city back, basically.
Is this primarily a music project or a reconciliation project?
That depends on who you ask, actually. If you ask me, it's primarily a reconciliation project. We organize it. It exists in order to bring people together. But it only works because we focus on the music. It wouldn't work if we brought people together for the sake of bringing people together. So because the music lessons are good, the teachers are excellent musicians, the trainers that we bring from the Netherlands are also excellent trainers, it's a real investment in the young people of the city. They get real music lessons and the concerts are good. Everything we organize is good. And for that reason, a lot of people see it as being about the music. And that gives us credibility and that allows us to bring people together because we're bringing them together as musicians. So that's basically how it works.
When you get these groups of young people from Serb ethnicity, Albanian ethnicity together, what are they saying to each other and how do they respond?
Well, it's changed over the years. The first time that we organized it, we didn't exist as a school in Mitrovica, so there wasn't any context. Then when we brought people together, there was a lot of kind of hesitation and suspicion, and people were very careful, and it took really a whole week for people to kind of make contact and become friends. Now it happens on the first day, but that's also because people know from their friends what will happen, they know what to expect, and there's also some kind of trust. I've heard kids say when they've been asked, like, well, how is it? Are you worried about who will come from the other side? And they say no, because they're rock school kids. So they know that there's, in a way, a kind of pre-selection. They trust the organization, so they know that we're not bringing any gung-ho nationalists from the other side, so it's fine.
And so you're not doing turbo folk lessons?
No. No, turbo folk is completely, it's our number one enemy. What's really important when we bring them together is that we're actually taking the kids out of the tension. So there's not just the fact that they come together, there's also the fact that they're out of the kind of social control of their own environment. And that in itself is a big relief to the kids. So that opens them up right there. They're not in Mitrovica where everybody feels watched and nobody feels quite comfortable doing whatever they please to do.
What's your biggest success then from this project, from the years that you've been running it?
We had a mixed band called the Architects. They came out of one of these summer schools. They were kids who really liked playing together. They had a good vibe, and we decided to provide coaching and some tour moments in order to keep them together. They became a really good band with their own material. They also fell apart last September, so that was after they'd been playing together for about a year and a half. Because they were good and they were visible, they became like a focal point for the press, because they were, more than the school itself, an example of kids from the two sides. And then for teenagers to be lifted out as kind of ambassadors for reconciliation, that put them under immense pressure in their own communities. So they decided as a band to stop. Now they're coming back together again. They will be coming this August to Skopje to play again, but only with very strong assurances that they won't be exposed to any press.
Deloni there in Mitrovica in Kosovo. You can catch more of this week's Urbanist on Reconciling Cities tomorrow night or tonight, depending on where you are, at 1900 hours London time.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with the latest on Spain's corruption scandal. And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Emma Nelson. The time is 9:41 in Barcelona and 8:41 here in London, but it is to Spain where we're going to head next.
Liam Aldous is our man in Madrid. Welcome back to the programme, Liam. Things just keep getting stickier and stickier for the country's prime minister.
Yeah, this scandal just gets bigger by the day, and it's all because Luis Bárcenas, who's the ex-treasurer who's at the centre of this slush fund scandal embroiling the government, appeared in court on Monday, and he brought with him about 9 folders and a few pen drives with hundreds, if not thousands, of documents implicating the PM and the ruling party in the scandal. So they've been trickling out over the last few days, and there's a promise that there more will come. So one of the revelations that's hit the papers today is the head of Spain's Supreme Court is actually a registered donor and affiliate of the PP, which is actually prohibited by law. So this is a huge scandal.
And it's startling stuff that Prime Minister Rajoy has essentially been silent throughout this whole ordeal.
Yeah, he just is refusing to talk. So I was talking on Monday about how he actually was forced to appear in a press conference because the Polish Prime Minister was in town. So he actually had refused to speak to the media. He's just not talking to the media. But he had to actually appear with the Polish Prime Minister. And when it came to ask the journalist, it was the term for the journalist to ask questions, he actually ignored the set order, which is the established order for the journalist who was going to ask the questions, and actually just asked to let the ABC journalist, which is a very right-wing paper, ask a question. And his response was actually pre-written. He was reading his response to this supposed question at a press conference. So he hasn't actually fronted the media and the questions. They have so many questions, and you can tell this in press conferences. The media is so eager to ask questions because when they do get a chance, they usually ask about 5 questions in one go. So it makes it very easy for the Prime Minister to avoid answering the questions because they ask so many questions.
Liam, where is this going? I mean, how long has Rajoy got?
Well, he actually has an absolute majority in the parliament, and he's pretty... I think he's more relied on the fact that the Spanish justice system is so cumbersome and so slow that he can actually hide behind that fact. And so he has the support of his party. They're all backing him up and really supporting him. So I think he's just going to weather the storm. He's actually Galician as well. It comes down to the fact where the Prime Minister is from. And Galicians never really reveal the full deck of cards, if you will. There's an old saying in Spain that if you cross a Galician on the stairs, you don't know whether they're coming up or down. So Rajoy never really, even if he was forced to talk, he would never really say anything clear because, I mean, even when he responded to this scandal in January, he said that everything was a lie except a few things. Well, so that really sums it up.
Liam, the PP party does have an absolute majority, but there must be some growing sense, at least politically speaking, that people in his own party are getting a sense that this is a corruption scandal that isn't necessarily going to go away. And this also, of course, coincides with the opposition leader preparing to bring on a motion in parliament.
Yes, like I said, he does have the support of most of his party. There are a few people in the party. The ex-premier of Madrid, Esperanza Aguirre, has been the most vocal in the media and within the party about this scandal, but she doesn't really have the numbers to really bring on any leadership contest. But like you said, the opposition is actually preparing a censure motion, which will be the third in Spanish history, but it would just basically be kind of a symbolic act because they don't have a opposition or the opposition. Opposition parties don't have a majority, so they've actually said that they know that it won't bring on the fall of the government, but it will register their discontent, so that will probably happen this week.
Let's move on to this this story about Franco and a sculpture who put him in a freezer. That's the only way that I could introduce it. Could you flesh it out, please?
Yeah, it's quite odd, isn't it? Basically, this happened in last year's Arco, which is the Spanish Contemporary Art Fair. A young artist, a young sculptor, did a sculpture of Franco and put him in the freezer. It was called Always Franco. Basically, it was meant to say that the image of Franco and the idea of Franco has been frozen in the Spanish consciousness ever since he died. And the Franco Foundation, which is a foundation which defends Franco's, the ex-dictator's honour, actually sued the artist because they thought it was quite offensive. So this, like I was saying before, the justice system is so slow, so only just came, this was in February last year, year. I only just came to court this week, and the judge eventually threw it out and said that they didn't have cause to just to. He was actually asking for €18,000 for in damages, apparently. But it's kind of opened a can of worms because there's actually a group of artists called the Artists Against the Anti-Fascist Artists Platform, and they've actually done a few art projects which are even more offensive, which has the Franco Foundation all riled up. One of them included placing the profile of Franco on a pubis bone and using, I'll say, a very taut phallus as his outstretched saluting arm, which obviously got them very angry. And another one by Cuco Suarez was a performance in which she extracted a liter of her own blood and then bathed in it as a symbolic portrait of the military coup. So you can just imagine those very kind of those fascists in the Franco Foundation fan club really getting quite angry about all these kind of artworks.
Sounds like a lot of fun, Liam. Up next, you have one last story. The festival that's been happening in Pamplona, in the headlines, though, for all the wrong reasons.
Yes, I was actually in San Sebastian last week, and I got kind of like the trickle of all the tourists. A lot of them Australian, unfortunately, were in San Sebastian.
It's your countrymen, Liam.
Yeah, I know, but it was quite odd. It felt like I was in Bali or something. There were so many Australians there because they'd all been in San Fermines in Pamplona. It's a 7-day festival, and this year was quite horrible, actually. In one of the races, you can imagine the running of the bulls is quite frenetic. Everyone's running with adrenaline. There's bulls coming. You get to the end, which is the bull ring, and you're running into the bull ring with all the bulls, and the door is closed to the bull ring. What happens? Well, there was a huge, human wall. Basically, it was a stampede, but they couldn't go anywhere, and the bulls basically just ran into all these people. So if you actually look for the video, it's a shocking and horrific video, and there was 23 people injured. One of them was an Australian girl. She was like 23 years old, and she was actually gored in the chest. So, I mean, this is brought into question once again, the management of this festival. It's getting a bit out of control. So many people are coming there each year. So they basically will have to review basically how they manage this race.
Future indeed is uncertain for that festival in Pamplona. And Liam Aldis, our man in Madrid, many thanks for joining us on the program.
Past the hour here. If one was determined to stage an event aimed at enhancing the status of women, perhaps the word housewife would be kept well away from proceedings. Sadly, though, the organisers of India's Housewife Awards failed to grasp this, and it's led to accusations that the event, which was staged this last weekend in New Delhi, was a toe-curling nonsense.
Well, Emma, in the event's defence, women who stay at home and raise families are doing about as difficult and important a day's work as it is possible to do. Well, furthermore, the organisers of the event are an NGO which focuses on women's rights. Well, earlier Monocle's Andrew Muller spoke to Ashanti Omkar, an Indian culture critic.
What was the nature of this event? Was there any difference between this and one of your old school beauty contests?
Well, to me, it actually seems like the Miss World for, you know, really rich ladies, which I think is what has attracted a lot of criticism, because these are ladies who the husbands want to be staying at home and who give them credit cards and say, you know what, you've gotten through to these housewife awards. Here you go. Here's my credit card. Go out and buy yourself whatever you want. So I think it is one of those kind of strange things. On one side, I do believe that a housewife is a very important role. And I think that, you know, raising kids and all of that is very important. But I think a lot of criticism has come from the fact that there are lots of women who manage to balance both. But this is focused mostly on ladies who literally stay at home, who have lots of money, so they don't really need to work, which it isn't great in this day and age, in my opinion.
So the obvious questions that have been focused on this event are the nature of the role of women in India today. How much has that changed over the last few decades as India has emerged as an economic powerhouse?
You know, from my opinion, in a lot of industries in India, you see women leading the way. You see women who are empowered, who are out there. The CEO of Pepsi Cola, for example, is a woman who was educated and brought up in India, Indira Nui. So it is amazing to see that this is one side of India, but then you see the other side of India where a woman is preferred to be staying at home, and a lot of these ladies who have lots of money and very rich husbands much prefer them to be at home being ladies of leisure. And I think there is this big kind of gap between the two of those. So people who have to work, you know, who are very poor, for example, in India, are out there and women are working, and then there are ladies like this. So that gap is huge, and over the years you see so many amazing Indian women doing amazing things all over the world, but then you also see something like this that feels very regressive.
I mean, women are still only a third of India's workforce. And as you point out, a lot of those people are working at a subsistence level where they don't really have a choice. They have to do absolutely everything to live from one meal to the next. Do you think there will come a point in the next few years of India's development at which we will witness a major feminist revolution along the lines of the one that happened in the West from the 60s onwards?
It's really difficult to make that kind of prediction, because I see both sides of this equation, even in the UK. And you know, I've had friends who have personally experienced this, where their husbands want to be the main kind of caregiver for the family. They want to be the breadwinner for the family, and so they want the woman to be the caregiver who's looking after the house, has a meal on the table, and you know, they want to come home to that. And it's something that is not just in India. I'm seeing it with Indian Asians around the world. So it is a really difficult one to predict, because it would be nice to see this changing, but I couldn't really say at the moment, because I do see too much of this going on in reality.
And finally then, do you think on balance events like this are a help or a hindrance?
Well, again, I personally think that you know, that they had good intentions with this, and I wish that they had actually said, we would like to give pick ladies who actually do a bit of both, because you know, I see a lot of Indian ladies who are doing a lot of really good entrepreneurial work, which I think is very important, and a lot of people who give their time to charity, for example, who also come from very rich households. So it's not necessarily ladies who are given a credit card and told to, you know, go and shop because they've been picked as the winner of a housewife award. So again, it is one of those things where, you know, you sit there and you think, well, I can see it from both points of view. This could kind of empower these ladies, because their job as a housewife is incredibly tough, and they are doing a lot of work. But of course, if there are ladies who have servants to do all this work, because in India, that is something that is very much the case. If you've got the money, you have a servant to do everything. So you don't even need to reach out for a glass of water. Somebody will give that to you. And if that is the case, and those are the sorts of ladies that are winning these, I think it is definitely regressive.
Ashanti Omkar there, talking to Andrew Muller a little earlier.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Emma Nelson. It's time now for us to review this morning's British front pages, and the man whose job it is to do that is, of course, Monocle's news editor, Tom Edwards. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Phil.
How are you?
Yeah, you know, I'm not bad.
You seem a bit... are you okay?
Yeah, no, it's just because as perusing the UK papers today, I realised that we are in that slight kind of summer silly season already.
Which actually is to be embraced occasionally, Tom.
I will embrace it in part, okay. But the rest of the time I'll fly into a furious rage about it.
Well, you seemed yesterday when we were having a gentle chat, you said it is impossible to be unhappy in this weather.
Well, that's true. And of course, the weather, Emma, is a good place to start, because there's nothing that the Brits like more than talking about the weather, whether it's too hot, too cold, too dry, too wet, or just right. It's kind of like a fairy story. But the newspapers are extremely excited. And I've been scanning through to find animal-related heat stories
Which
from here in the UK.
Not that difficult.
It's not that difficult. My personal favourite, and I think a clear winner, is in the London Times, which has a photograph of, and bear with me on this, an alpaca in rugby. Mm. Not an exceptional story. They're quite popular now, alpacas. Apparently they're good sort of guard animals, looking after other flock animals. I didn't know that.
And clearly quite easy to spot.
Exactly.
If.
When they're in this condition, protected, it says, with pink dye and a sun hat. Whew. Now, the sun hat, I'm with the alpaca on that. I can see how that helps.
It's
keep the heat off.
It's got massive sunglasses.
It's got sunglasses with it as well. Protected with pink dye. Why is that helping?
Is it like alpaca sunscreen or something?
Well,
possibly. Right.
But I just think maybe... The joke is on the alpaca in this instance.
Possibly. Or maybe the joke is on all of us that we are so fascinated
exactly.
by the
but
alpaca.
But I like his look at his little face.
He's a good
cute.
Looker.
The Independent has a much more traditional animal photo. Here's a little penguin being fed a little fishy.
Now, that's penguin cute. Story has been knocking around London for at least a week. And I think major news outlets have been trying to say we're not doing the penguin story. Basically, the penguins are hot at London Zoo, so they're giving them ice. Simple as that.
Very popular.
And it is one of those traditional beginning of the school summer holiday picture stories. And it is the Independent what has cracked.
Exactly. Someone was going to... It's like otters. They're always getting iced...
Battersea Park Zoo is giving the meerkats ice cream.
And there's some other sort of traditional favourites, Emma, that are dominating papers. In the Independent, as well as the Penguins, they've got a good coverage of this row that's brewing over the Open Golf Championships. It starts at Muirfield, of course, in Edinburgh. And the chief executive of the Royal and Ancient Golf Club, which organises the event, has defended a controversial ban that Muirfield has on women members. He claims it's a way of life, men-only golf clubs, and he claims some people rather like it.
Hmm.
Well, so one man, in the face of political
One correctness. Man who doesn't like it is the high-profile golfer Rory McIlroy, saying he condemning the policy of the golf club.
But he still turned up to play.
I was about to say, there's no sign of a boycott, is there?
I'm sure he could think of sort of 1.5 million reasons why he can still play despite that.
Let's move on to the Sterling Prize.
Yeah, I mean, this is really interesting. So the Sterling Prize, a high-profile REBA award for the best building of the year here in the UK. Their shortlist is revealed. Quite divisive. I know Phil... You weren't a fan of some of the entries.
I'm not a fan of the Park Hill Phase 1 in Sheffield, which is this mammoth old council estate there in Sheffield. It's pretty hideous.
But they've been intelligently reconfigured, Phil.
I don't think it works.
Some people have suggested you should be intelligently reconfigured.
Sheffield is
That's a low blow.
But the big favourite is the Bishop Edward King Chapel. That's the favourite.
Because it is traditionally beautiful.
I think it's very, very striking. There's a wonderful picture of its sort of impressive rooftop, this amazing space. It's described in The Guardian as a crisscrossing cat's cradle of paper-thin branches.
See, I'm a fan of the Park Hill development. I know Phil doesn't like it.
Right, it's colourful, it's summery.
It's not just that, it's quite clever urban thinking, which is something that has to be borne in mind with this.
Apparently,
when you're trying
to redevelop. It also has thrilling glass lifts.
Which... Frankly, you can keep your lifts. Just exactly. A good bit of urban redevelopment.
And Tom, we have time for just one more.
Well, very, very
fun
briefly.
Story,
yeah. In the Daily Telegraph, they report on the annual exam howlers that are noted in the Times Higher Education magazine, including things Alfred Hitchcock had recurring themes in his movies because he was a torched Catholic. Ebola virus apparently can lead to death in some cases, fatally. Oof. And this is my personal favourite. Two eminent Victorians. A student wrote this. Sex has puzzled biologists ever since it was discovered by Darwin and Mendel.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. That's all we have time for today's programme. Our thanks to our producer Daphne Denis, our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Zoe Tennant, and our studio manager Alex Funnell. Up next, after the news, Robert Bound will bring you this week's episode of Culture.
Clemency Burton-Hill and I will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Emma Nelson. It's goodbye and thank you for listening.
Bye-bye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.